This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
The ATMs weren't going dark, that the banks in Main Street, unlike Wall Street, were in good shape, that this whole crisis, this so-called meltdown, was primarily in the canyons of Wall Street and was designed to bail out Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs. And that is very different from the received wisdom from what they told you at the time, but I think I document it pretty well in the chapters that cover that in my book.
Well, I guess sort of like a precursor of many bailouts that came after that. But one thing you talk about, let's start with basics. What exactly is sound money?
Well, sound money is basically a notion that the central bank's job is simply to be a standby source of liquidity for the banking system based on good collateral presented when banks need cash in order to fund deposit outflows. And that is a very different notion than what the Fed is doing today. The Fed is basically the monetary central planner of the United States. It is attempting to control everything: GDP, employment, housing, retail sales, the stock market, the price of bonds, the price of money, the yield curve on the Treasury debt. And that is leading to a broken financial system and huge windfalls for traders who can take advantage of the free money that the Fed is passing out. So the Fed's activist, interventionist, massive bond buying campaign is 180 degrees opposite of what the founders intended in 1914 when the Fed was established. They wanted only a limited passive role for the Fed, and it has turned the whole scheme inside out, and that's one of the things that I document in the long history in my book.
Well, like corporations and banks should be allowed to either succeed or fail on their own.
Exactly, and that's the fundamental rule of free market. I mean, if you don't have financial discipline, and that's really what, when people get over their skis, so to speak, when they speculate too much, when they use too much leverage, when they make huge bets that turn out sour, then there has to be consequences. If you don't allow failure, bankruptcy, reorganization, then you're going to sort of bias the market one-sided towards speculation, and that is the kind of casino markets that we've gradually developed over the last decades as a result of the Fed's easy money and constant coddling of Wall Street, and coming to the rescue as they did in 1998 when long-term capital was going down and should have, coming to the rescue in 2001 when the dot-com craze crashed. They should have let that burn out. Coming to the rescue in 2007, 2008 when the housing bubble crashed and then the Wall Street banks went down at the time of Lehman. So all of these rescue efforts are undermining the basic rules of free markets and the basic discipline that's needed in the financial system to, curtail and contain speculation. So we're just building up the third bubble now, and I think there's another bust sooner or later lurking around the corner.
Well, is any bank too big to fail?
No, I think that's a great question. Uh-huh. But what we should have learned from the crisis of 2008, when everyone was panicked, and you even had President Bush, who supposedly was a Republican and an advocate of free market, saying, "I'm setting aside the rules of the free market in order to save the free market system." Well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. But the theory, anyway, was these banks were so interconnected and involved in the entire global financial system that if they weren't saved, the whole thing would come unstuck. I demonstrate in my book that isn't true, but if they believed it, then after the crisis passed, and surely 5 years later, we're well past the crisis, why haven't the too big to fail banks been reformed and busted up? In other words, my contention in the book is that if they're too big to fail, then they're too big to exist. And therefore, they should be broken up, and there should be a size limit put on banks, and we shouldn't allow banks that are involved in trading and hedge funds and money management and underwriting to have deposit insurance, which the taxpayers back, or to have access to the cheap money at the Fed discount window to bail themselves out if they get in trouble. None of these reforms have been made. I mean, they tell you they passed Dodd-Frank. That is, a bill that will do nothing because it's just a enabling act that requires 400 studies and years worth of rulemaking, and is so full of loopholes that no real dangerous behavior by the banks, in my judgment, is going to be curtailed. So again, we copped out, kicked the can down the road, and the system is just being set up for another crisis. No one can predict when, but if you don't change the behavior, the big banks are even bigger today than they were at the time of the 2008 crisis. You're just asking for trouble. And that's one of the failures of our financial system. It is really run by Wall Street. The policy being made in Washington is what Wall Street would like to see in order to keep the game going, that really is not in the interest of the overall economy.
Mm-hmm. Well, the big controversy now, well, for quite a while, has been between the Keynesians like Krugman and Bernanke on one hand and the austerity people on the other. And it seems to me both of them depend on continued growth to make their case.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. But, I think it's a little more complicated than the Keynesians versus austerity. On the one hand, the Keynesians really have no magic formula. There's nothing behind the screen, so to speak, except borrowing from the future and burdening future generations and future taxpayers with money that we issue from the Treasury today, or debt we issue from the Treasury, and then pass it out either in spending programs or tax rebates or the temporary tax cuts that we had, like the 2% payroll abatement and so forth. But that once that money is spent and passed out, it is not triggered any so-called multiplier effects. It just goes into the economy. People spend money that they haven't earned, that they haven't produced, and then we add it to our national balance sheet, to the debt of the United States, which is $17 trillion and rising rapidly. So I think the Keynesians are wrong. They're just borrowing. Now, the people who talk about austerity are not saying that austerity is some kind of tonic that will make everything better. They're saying austerity is something that happens to you when you're in financial trouble or when you're on the border of being broke. And you don't choose austerity because somehow it'll make you healthier or more prudent. You end up in austerity because you have no choice. You can't keep borrowing. And that's where I think we are today. We're drifting into austerity. We're going to have tax increases, whether people like it or not. We're going to have major spending cuts year after year, not because it's a positive tonic in itself, but because it's necessary. We can't keep borrowing $1 trillion a year. That's where austerity comes from. It comes when you run out of borrowing capacity. And I think we're getting very close to that.
Well, what happens if there is no growth? It seems to me if they're right, we've had, this economic crisis now for several years, and the growth seems to be really very anemic. I think there was just a report came out from the IMF the other day that growth is only about 3% or something like that, which seems optimistic. But what happens if there is no growth?
Well, I think that's a new reality that we're going to have to cope with and face down. We had a party, I say, for the last 30 years. Much of it was fueled by debt growth, not sustainable, you know, productivity and work and production. And I can demonstrate that if both household, business, and government debt grew by from $5 trillion to $56 trillion over the last 30 years. And that wasn't because the economy went up by 10 times. That was because leverage in every sector of the economy, the ratio of debt to income, went up enormously for households, for businesses, and obviously today government too. So when you borrow all that money in the short run, you get a economic high, right? It does stimulate spending, consumption, and so the economy booms for a while. But when you run out of capacity to keep borrowing like households did in 2008, then you're back to the underlying or organic growth rate without the added boost from, you know, another dollar of borrowing, so to speak. And that's where we are now. And if we get 1% to 2% growth over the next decade, I think we'll be lucky because we have no more borrowing capacity left. We're going to be struggling with solvency and the after effects of this huge debt boom that I talked about. It's payback time, and so you have to pay the interest. You're going to have to pay higher taxes to fund the government side of the debt that's been created, because when interest rates normalize, the interest cost to the federal government of carrying all this debt will soar, and no one's even thinking about that yet, but they should be. So it's so what is ahead is low growth, as you say. What is ahead is a struggle for solvency, which means people are going to have a hard time servicing their debt and paying the taxes. And yet that's what we that is the circumstance that was inherent when we had this great debt party that everybody thought was so fantastic for the last 30 years. We're on the other side of that now, I guess is what I'm saying. We're on the payback side rather than the boom side of that that huge national mistake.
Well, we are talking with David Stockman, the budget director in the Reagan administration and the author of a book called The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America. What about, you know, I didn't see it in you, what about banks like the, in North Dakota? They have a state bank and they don't, so when if you do float a bond measure, the money does not go to, interest does not go to Wall Street. It sort of goes back into the local economy.
Well, you know, I mean, I guess people, some people like Krugman say, well, don't worry that much about debt. We owe it to ourselves. You know, I don't buy that. I think when a government or a family takes on a lot of debt, it doesn't matter who owns it, they have an obligation to pay the interest. They have an obligation to repay the principal over time. That becomes a burden. That constrains what they can do in the future and may even drag down their standard of living if they get too deep in debt. So I don't really think it makes that big a difference whether the debt is issued by a state bank or bonds are sold in Wall Street, which then are absorbed by the Federal Reserve. But I do think we have a huge problem in our banking system that has not even been remotely addressed by Dodd-Frank. We basically need to go back to Glass-Steagall, or what I call Super Glass-Steagall, and say that all the gambling houses that want to be in proprietary trading and, you know, these huge derivative kinds of contracts and commodity gambling and so forth, that's fine, but they have to be pure free enterprise institutions. They get no backing from the taxpayer in any way, shape, or form, in the form of deposit insurance or in the form of access to the Fed's free money window. And if we did that and said banks can only be in the narrow business of making loans to local business or to mortgages to households and taking deposits if they want to have deposit insurance from the taxpayers and if they want to have access to the Fed window, If we made that sharp, clear demarcation, we would dramatically reduce the danger of the banking system. We would then put aside this overhang of too big to fail, and that's the reform I think we really need to make. I also think deposit insurance is a very dangerous thing, and it gets abused because when you can raise unlimited money with deposit insurance, banks don't operate prudently. So I've actually argued that we need some kind of postal savings bank for people who are worried about their savings, and that obviously would be backed by the government, but that regular banks should operate without deposit insurance. So there's many things that need to be done to reform the banking system, and we're not doing any of those. It's just status quo, kick the can, let's see if somehow it won't happen again, and I think that's a very imprudent posture to take.
Well, let's talk about Social Security, because I'm trying to figure this out myself. It's now the Social Security, they build up a trust fund, right? You know, they have a surplus of money. Now, aren't they are required to buy treasury bonds? Is that correct?
Yes, but, you know, I think that's a great question, and there's a great mythology that the bonds they have purchased over the years mean anything. It's all intergovernmental paper shuffling. I call it confetti. There is nothing in the trust fund. It's the greatest myth being pulled, put off on the people of this country by Washington that has ever been undertaken. All of that money that came into the trust fund in excess of payouts each year for several decades got spent immediately by the general fund for cotton subsidies, student loans, aircraft carriers, whatever, paying salaries of federal employees. So it's gone. There's nothing in there except an IOU. And the only way the Treasury can make good on that IOU is to borrow more money and then to pay benefits and Social Security or raise taxes further.
Well, isn't
so I think we have to face the fact there is no trust fund. Social Security isn't insurance. It's a pay-as-you-go scheme. And it's a very bad one right now because it puts a huge payroll tax on low-wage workers. You know, they pay 15% for Social Security and Medicare between the employee and employer, and thereby it's a huge job destroyer. It's a huge income destroyer if you're at the minimum wage or a little bit above it or even quite a bit above it. Now, what happens to those taxes when they go into the trust fund? They're immediately sent out in benefits, and a lot of it's going to affluent retirees who don't need it. So we're taxing today the low-wage worker in order to fund unneeded benefits for the affluent retiree. It is crazy, and yet the progressives and the liberals keep defending it. Won't change the status quo. Say Social Security isn't part of the problem because of this trust fund myth. It's actually regressive. It taxes the on the margin. It taxes the low-wage working-age family today to transfer benefits to people that need it, of course, but also to those at the top who don't. So my argument is let's get rid of Social Security trust fund mythology. Let's be honest that it's pay-as-you-go. Let's find some other way to raise the revenue to pay benefits to people who need them. That is the millions of retirees who have a Social Security check and not much more to depend on. But get the burden off the neck of low-wage workers by rolling back the payroll tax and stop wasting money on high-income affluent retirees who don't need the benefits because they have their own pensions and assets and investments and so forth. That is the biggest issue, I think, facing the federal government today, and it's not even being discussed, because both parties want to perpetuate the myth that there's no problem here when there is a huge problem.
Well, isn't the government obligated to pay off those treasury bills? I mean,
well,
if
sure,
they
the
default, it would be the first time in history.
Those treasury bills, but it can only do it by borrowing more money, and we're already, $17 trillion in debt. or to get the cash, if it can't borrow the money, which I think would be totally wrong, then it has to raise taxes. So my point is, are we going to raise taxes even more in order to fund benefits to affluent retirees? That's the first point. And second, if we're raising new taxes, then what are we doing about the existing payroll tax? You keep that roughly 15% rate in place, and you're going to perpetuate the problem of not enough jobs and the problem of millions of people dropping out of the labor force because they can't find employment and they end up on food stamps or they end up destitute or they end up moving back in with the parents, but they don't have the opportunity to get a job in the private market. And so therefore, Social Security payroll tax is a job destroyer, and it's unfortunate that the Liberal Democrats and the progressives keep defending the system when it's undermining the very objective jobs that they constantly talk about.
Well, suppose a trust fund had taken this money and instead of U.S. Treasury bills bought, private corporate bonds or else bonds from some other country, and then that entity all of a sudden defaulted. Wouldn't they be held to pay?
Well, that might be, but if they bought IBM bonds, for instance, there's two points about that. One, it's not likely that IBM is going to default, so there was always, relatively risk-free investments they could have made. But secondly, here's the key point. If they bought IBM bonds, that money that came in, let's say in 1996, could not have been spent to buy aircraft carriers. It could not have been spent that same day it came in to pay salaries of the federal government. It would have been set aside in an asset that could be liquefied, that was real cash that could be used in the year 2013 to pay somebody's benefits. That is the fundamental difference between pretending that you're owing it between two government agencies and actual real assets that have cash value in the future. Now, what we have is phony debt, or phony assets in the trust fund. They don't mean anything. They only mean that the Treasury promises to tax people or borrow more money to pay off that paper. It's already been spent. That's my point. It's been spent. Trillions have been spent that came in from payroll taxes on general government purposes. It's gone. It can never be gotten back. And that's one of the reasons that we're in the big hole that we're in.
Spend either wisely or foolishly.
Right, right. It may have been wise. It may have been foolish. But the point was, it shouldn't have been spent on general government. It should have built up in what Al Gore once called the lockbox. But it never was. It was just spent. And now we're beginning to face the music. Even today, Social Security on a cash basis is $50 billion short. There's $50 billion a year going out in excess for benefits, in excess of the payroll tax revenue coming in. Even if you thought the payroll tax at this high destructive rate is a good idea, which I don't. So, it's only a matter of time before the day of reckoning, big time, happens on Social Security. And we're not talking about small dollars here. Social Security will be costing $1 trillion a year soon, in about 2 or 3 years. And on top of that, you have Medicare, which is the same thing, same phony trust fund. There's nothing there, which is another $600 billion. So we're talking about $1.6 trillion a year of spending supported by trust funds that are phony. That's how severe this problem is.
Well, I guess we have about a minute left. I happen to think it's energy that makes the economy run. And how does a free market deal with expensive oil?
I think the free market deals with expensive oil the right way. The price goes up, and when the price goes up, there is a huge incentive on the conservation side for people to find ways to get their traveling done or their home heated or their power generated on fewer BTUs. High prices are the mother's milk of conservation, of efficiency, savings. And on the other hand, higher prices also encourage alternative forms of investment and therefore alternative forms of energy supply, whether it's solar or electric vehicles or anything else. But as long as we keep trying to keep taxes on energy low and keep price of energy down, and, you know, gas in real terms, gasoline in real terms today is no higher per gallon than it was in 1973 when the first Arab oil embargo occurred, okay? So what has happened over the last 40 years, the price of energy has stayed low, and therefore we've not had enough conservation. So the answer to the energy scarcity issue is free market pricing. And if we need to do it to accelerate things, an energy tax, a gasoline tax, or a tax on imported oil that would raise the cost to our domestic economy of using so much liquid hydrocarbon and thereby encourage both conservation and new sources of energy at the same time.
Time is up right now. We've been talking with David Stockman, former budget director on the Reagan administration, author of a book that is causing a big stir, The Great Deformation. Thank you very much for being with us.
Very good to be with you.
And good morning from KBOO Portland, just about a minute before 10 o'clock. Coming up in 15 minutes at 10:15 on Flashpoints, Robert Parry reports on Ronald Reagan's role in the extermination of hundreds of Mayan villages in the 1980s. And we'll remember the contribution of Sal Castro, who walked out with his Chicano students in the legendary actions of 1968. At 11 on Between the Covers, David Naiman speaks with Portland writer Monica Drake about her second novel, The Stud Book, an exploration of the complexities of what parenthood means today. And at 11:30 on the Radio Zine, Sarah Sneath interviews Noah Husson about a bicycle trip through American communities that are DIY building a new culture of sustainability and sharing. That's all coming up. But up next, it's headlines, interviews, and commentary. It's Air Cascadia with host Chris Andre. And that's right after this on KBOO.
Corporations are not people. Money is not speech. Author and radio show host Tom Hartman is referring to a growing movement in this country to pass a 28th Amendment to the Constitution. On Friday, April 26th at 7 p.m., Hartman returns to Portland to speak on We the People, not We the Corporations. That's at the First Unitarian Church at Southwest 12th Avenue and Main Street. He will also be speaking in Salem on Saturday, March 27th at 1 p.m. at the Grand Theater on Northeast High Street. You can refer to the KBOO Community Events page for more information or firstunitarian.org.
KBOO Board Elections 2013. KBOO members, do you have talents in fundraising, development, or new media? Are you excited about the possibilities for KBOO's future?
Are you an active member? Then here's your chance to bring your know-how to the KBOO Foundation Board of Directors.
Applications are now being accepted until June 28th, with candidate training on June 30th. To apply, go to kboo.fm/board elections or email kboo elections@gmail.com.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Thursday, April 18th, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. All of the mainstream news headlines this week seem to be focused on violence of one sort or another. It seems there is an atmosphere of ambient terrorism that is casting a long shadow across the land. If it's not rice and powder in envelopes, it's explosions at fertilizer plants, and of course the Boston Marathon. And below that, below the surface, bubbling along, there are more events that simply have not been reported. This week, of course, CISPA comes up for a vote more further endangering one's online privacy. There are the connections between today's stories are more important and will last longer. They will have longer lasting effects on society than the stories themselves, which will be quickly forgotten. First, this from the National Weather Service. Today, we've got cloudy skies and it's 50-50 as far as rain is concerned. Highs around 55. Tonight, 100% chance of rain with lows around 50, except in rural areas where temperatures could go down to around 45. Tomorrow, showers, highs 55 to 60, and wind picking up a bit, 5 to 15 for Friday night, overcast and a bit of a drizzle, lows around 45 and breezy. The alternative forecast for it's the first quarter of flower moon in Gemini. The moon is 7 days old, and everything that we spoke of yesterday still obtains, of course, today. Good time to plant stuff. It's a waxing moon, and of course, it's an even better time to forage. So, that said, the alternative forecast as well as the conventional forecast out of the way. We are going to dive right in. Today, we are going to try to reach a gentleman by the name of Bo Groskopf. He is, of course, best known for his work on the drone situation. He's the author of several books on terrorism, including Strategic Terror, The Politics and Ethics of Aerial Bombardment. And he has been very vocal on the subject of terrorism. He points out that at first President Obama called the Boston bombing a tragedy, and that's the label that he was roundly he pounded down for using. The right emerged from its den and attempted to deliver a thrashing. Day later, Obama had said that it was an act of terrorism. And to recall the, of course, the recent fracas in Libya, when an